attitude. We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Callum Robertson, a Liberal Democrat council candidate for this upcoming year's May's local elections for Bethnal Green East, who has also been a Lib Dem candidate at parliamentary level. Welcome to the podcast, Callum.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on, Callum. And the first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide that you wanted to put yourself forward as a Lib Dem council candidate at this May's local elections?
I think it's two reasons. One, I give a damn about the community I live in, but being very blunt. The second one is I think everyone should have the opportunity to vote for the party they support. Mm. And part of that is people like me who don't have a very high chance of winning, putting their names forward to be a candidate and really hitting home the message that actually there's no no-go areas for Lib Dems.
Bethnal Green East, as you say, is not a seat that has previously been held by the Liberal Democrats. What is your strategy in terms of getting out there and meeting with local residents and engaging them with your message?
My strategy is very much to help people who have a realistic chance of getting elected under the Liberal Democrat banner get elected under the Liberal Democrat banner. Mm-hmm. We have target wards in our borough. We have two of them and some development wards. I think my job as what's colloquially known as paper candidate is to very much get out there and fight to make sure those people become councillors on May 2nd. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of your past experience, I mean, how do you think that has equipped you to help other candidates and to be a candidate yourself?
I think it brings with it a sort of a very interesting range of experience that makes me sort of quite uniquely equipped to help out sort of anywhere. I grew up in Peterborough, which is about 45 minutes north of King's Cross. Peterborough, quite evenly divided as a city. I'd experienced fighting both Labour and the Tories there. And moved down to Essex for uni, where I ran Colchester local party and ran for Parliament in Clacton up to the 2019 general election. I was fighting not only the Tories there, but the far right as well. Now I'm living in Tower Hamlets. I'm using that experience fighting sort of dodgy far right people to taking it to the Labour Council, who are also dodgy, and taking it to Aspire, who should be allowed nowhere near public office.
Now, in terms of the far right, that's obviously something that you've encountered in both Clacton and in Tower Hamlets. Are there any differences in terms of the groups that you've
just before you sort of say that, I'd say in Tower Hamlets, the far right isn't a huge issue. It's more mm-hmm. that you've got people who are extremists in a very different way.
Mm-hmm. So, well, in terms of that extremism then, in what ways is it different between Clacton and Tower Hamlets?
Sure. So Clacton, it's a lot more sort of like, so there was a guy called Andy Morgan, who was basically a fascist in all but name. And he can sue me if he thinks that's a particularly inappropriate aspersion of him. But he is a fascist in all but name, and he surrounds himself with thugs. He partakes in what can only be really described as gangster politics. Mm-hmm. Sort of your standard sort of like, convince the old grannies to vote for me by being a little bit charming, but also like there's always that veneer of respectability, but actually underneath that it's just thuggish. Mm. You've got people that look for ramen, who whilst very left wing within Tower Hamlets, very much cut from the same cloth, they have a veneer of respectability, a veneer of always looking out for people, but actually you scratch below the surface and the rumours are swirling around electoral fraud. I mean, look for Ramon was removed from office for electoral fraud and for sort of handing out contracts to his mates. Those people should not be allowed anywhere near office. And our job up to the 2nd of May and after the 2nd of May is making sure that we are giving an alternative vision to the people of Tower Hamlets to stop them being taken advantage of by these charlatans.
Mm. So, I mean, how effective do you think these veneers of respectability, as you describe it, are? I mean, do you think that they do actually convince a great deal of people, or is it only a certain amount of people that are convinced by them?
Well, we live under first past the post, so you don't have to convince everyone. I think that's one of the pitfalls of our electoral system, is you don't have to do that. But they convince 30 to 40% of the people who turn out and vote, which often is worryingly enough. I think if you look at 2010 and 2014, Luke Verhofstadt did win twice. I think it only logically follows that he has some sort of credibility as a candidate, given the fact he has won two elections in the past 12 years. For people to have honest. I mean, admittedly, the second one, I mean, I think one only needs to read the law reports, case outcome from the trial where he was removed from office to realise that he is about as dodgy as you get. Mm. We're talking contracts to your mates, you're talking his supporters, even this year, have been asking people who are professional carers to basically take the votes of the people they're caring for and vote. I mean, actually, I know it's recorded, but it's only audio, but this letter came with our polling cards today. And to quote the third paragraph, as a returning officer for these polls, I have the responsibility to ensure that there is confidence in the democratic process, ensure its integrity, and enable the delivery of free and fair elections. I'm focusing on the needs of electors to ensure that every vote remains secure, accessible, fair, transparent, and delivered efficiently. That I've never had to receive before. In Peterborough, where there's sort of a very tough electoral battle in some wards between our Tories and Labour, in Clacton, electoral fraud has never been an issue, but actually in Tower Hamlets it is. And the fact that the councillors having to go, well, please don't let people take your vote for you, please don't let people impersonate you, please don't do family voting, all of these are crimes. The fact that the council is having to put in place measures realistically because of the actions of Luke Verhofstadt and his ilk, I think that says a lot about the type of candidates that they are. In terms of being entirely inappropriate public office, in line with what the court judgment said.
I mean, do you think that, given what you've just said about Tower Hamlets and your experiences there, that this may be used as an argument in favour of voter ID? I mean, what's your take on that?
Like all good Liberal Democrats, I oppose voter ID. It disproportionately impacts ethnic minority communities. In a free society, we should have an electoral system and an electoral system safeguards that ensure that there is no voter fraud. And then out of, what, over 300 different local authority areas, there's maybe one or two that have an issue with voter fraud. One of them is Tower Hamlets. Tower Hamlets also has a disproportionately high Bangladeshi community. Bangladeshi community, ethnic minority background, less likely to have ID. Just because there's been historical voter fraud here, it doesn't mean that it gives the local council or the government the right to disenfranchise tens of thousands of Bangladeshi people who just want to exercise their democratic rights. That is fundamentally un-British. And I think the Tories' efforts to put that through Parliament now are nothing short of disgraceful. It's straight up the dictator's playbook.
How then do you think we can combat voter fraud in areas like Tower Hamlets then? I mean, what would you see as the best sort of like mechanism? I mean, obviously you've mentioned Uthman Rahman there, but I mean, in instances either relating to him or relating to other people, what would be the best method for combating it, do you think?
So, of the, what is it, in the last 10 years, and like six cases of successful voter fraud, caught out voter fraud, it's ludicrously low numbers out of the tens of millions of ballot papers that have been returned. I mean, when we say what is the solution, I find that when we pose it like that, that is a solution in search of a problem. voter fraud is not an issue in 99.99% of the UK. I think the actions of a few brave citizens after the 2014 election showed that the courts are perfectly adequately in place to stop voter fraud or punish voter fraud if it happens. And they overturned an election result. They removed a sitting mayor for the first time ever, and the only time ever, because that was their job and they were entitled to do so, and they came to that conclusion. Why do we need to bring in new laws when the current ones are working okay? It's like with the Coronavirus Act, the government only really used powers that already existed under different legislation. The Coronavirus Act was, again, a huge infringement on civil liberties. Same sort of principle, and it's something the Conservatives are very, very good at saying, oh, here's a problem. I think if you scratch by the surface, the people who are targeted by the problem tend to be minority communities, or targeted by the supposed problem, or the solutions to the supposed problem are minority communities. So I would go so far as to say voter fraud is outright racist. So voter ideas are outright racist, not voter fraud.
In just turning on to policies that you think would potentially benefit the people of Bethnal and also Tower Hamlets. I mean, what sort of policies do you think that the Lib Dems are putting forward that could benefit the people living in those communities if Liberal Democrat candidates are elected?
First of all, we have a good chance of getting some really good Lib Dems elected. We've got Dom Buxton in St Catherine's Wapping, a phenomenal candidate. He just plugs away. He does so much work for that community, and it's inspiring. You've got people like Guy Benson in Blackburn, Cuba Town. You've got Simon Tunnicliffe in Shadwell, alongside Rabina Khan, who's our existing councillor. So you can get people like that elected. I think when you look at the priorities, we have a cost of living crisis. Ed Davey launched the local election campaign for the Lib Dems nationally this morning, at which he was talking about the Tories have just become the high tax party. At a local level, I think he could do wonders to remove some of the lowest income people from council tax and stop pricing out working class people from London. But you can also tackle the recycling rates. Tower Hamlets is one of, if not the worst in the country for recycling rates. Now we're in the middle of an environmental crisis. Frankly, the council, the Labour on council can do better. Let's do that. Let's increase recycling rates and let's lower council tax for those who need it.
In terms of, I mean, you mentioned the cost of living crisis there. In terms of that crisis, what do you think councils could be doing, if they're not already doing it, to help people who are suffering from increases in the cost of living crisis? Now, of course, councils are limited in what they can do, but I mean, in terms of the powers that they have, what do you think that they could do more that perhaps they're not already doing to help people?
It's an interesting point that you say they're limited, because I take the opposite view. I think councils, and especially council leaders, have more day-to-day power over things like housing than people like members of parliament. What can we do as a council, as prospective councillors? Well, we can stop being so NIMBY, grow some balls and build some more houses. Housing is at its core a supply and demand issue. And anyone who tells you otherwise hasn't studied economics properly. It's as simple as that. If you have high prices and you get supply to outstrip demand, those prices will fall down. So what Tower Hamlets can do is go on a building revolution of affordable housing. It can continue policies such as building council housing to make sure the council housing list is shrunk, to make sure people are in safe, stable accommodation. And they can do things like tackle the cost of living crisis with relations to things like council tax bills, which means that fewer people will end up having to be priced out. The rent in my flat is going up by £700 a month in Tower Hamlets. So my flatmates and I have been forced to relocate because we're being priced out, and we're three professionals, three middle-class professionals who are being priced out. We're lucky in the sense that we can all afford somewhere. There are thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even 100,000 people in Tower Hamlets who don't have that privilege, don't have that choice, who aren't in professional middle-class jobs. Those people are being priced out, and it's the council's job to play its part in addressing that housing crisis. And that means building on a colossal scale.
In terms of, this is something I'm particularly interested to hear your thoughts on, in terms of increasing building and balancing that with environmental promises, how best do you think we can do that? Because of course, there's going to be arguments in terms of how exactly we develop particular areas and which areas shouldn't be developed and which should. I mean, what do you think in terms of that balance between making commitments to the environment and also increasing the housing supply?
If you want to look at bigger single source polluters within areas, lack of recycling rates, huge, huge issue. Cars, huge issue. Lack of affordable public transport, huge issue. I think people reflexively go to blame housing because it either makes their neighborhood ever so slightly less valuable or any other number of reasons, up to including just blatant NIMBYism. I think it becomes a false argument after a while. Let's tackle some of the causes around environmental concerns. Let's move to a green economy. Let's start investing in renewables, all of this. Let's make sure new builds have solar panels attached. Let's not shy away from onshore wind farms like the Conservatives are shying away from at the moment. Let's actually stop looking for excuses not to tackle the housing crisis, and let's just go and do it. Simple as that.
In terms of, though, I'm thinking specifically in terms of sort of like areas of land that are obviously going to be designated for planting trees, etc. How do you balance that with also about building more houses?
Rooftop gardens, green buildings. I mean, we are building hundreds of houses and flats and apartments near us. No one has ever threatened Mudchute Park. The green spaces are not an issue in Tower Hamlets. And I think that those who will campaign that they are being threatened are those campaigning on disingenuous grounds.
Just turning to wider national politics for a moment. One of the things that's obviously been noticeable in certain by-election results of late has been the Lib Dem success in areas that had previously been held by the Conservatives, Conservative-dominated areas. How do you think the Lib Dems are going to replicate that in a general election? And do you think that they're going to replicate that in a general election?
Yes. I think Boris Johnson offends the home counties and places like South West London. He offends people's sense of decency. People like their politicians, to be honest. And Boris Johnson fails that 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. If you look at some of our target seats coming up, seats we're hoping to win in the next general election, South Cams, Hitchin Harpenden, the new St Neots seat, so it's places like that are places we will hopefully pick up based on anti-Tory votes and people being pro-Lib Dems because they're proud of what we have to offer, because what we have to offer is frankly better than the Tories at the moment. For example, we're not shafting lower income people with high taxes. The Tories are. That's a pretty sellable message, and it's also the truth. That's how we win and replicate those successes from North Shropshire and Chesham and Lambshire.
And looking at that upcoming general election, potentially 2 years away, maybe a bit sooner, what do you think the Lib Dem position will be if we end up with a hung parliament? Say the Labour Party is not close enough to a majority and the Conservatives are not close enough to a majority. What do you think that the Lib Dems should do in a situation like that?
In this hypothetical situation, would the Lib Dems be the balance of power?
Well, I mean, it depends. Do you think that they would be?
I think it's entirely possible. And I think we should, if we could form a majority with the Conservatives or with Labour, I think we should keep our powder dry and get the best deal for the British people, because they're the people that matter. Any political party or group that's promising otherwise is frankly in it for themselves.
I'd like to turn now to something that's not happening in the future, but is happening now, which is, of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the war that is occurring there. Of course, we've seen various war crimes that have been reported, and it is a complete and utter humanitarian disaster. What do you think the government should be doing in response to Ukraine? Do you think that they're doing enough, or if they're not doing enough, what more do you think they should be doing?
I think the government likes to pretend it's doing a lot with Ukraine. They have been really, really loud and proud about their Ukrainian refugee crisis policy of taking lots of refugees, but actually that really realistically amounts to soddle. That amounts to a meagre £350 payment that they're struggling to process. It's got people on the right wing of politics exercised about it as well, in the sense that people are fundamentally very unhappy at how little the government's doing. So I don't think the government's doing enough, but I also think, and this is my position, not necessarily the Liberal Democrat position, I think we're being too timid. I think Vladimir Putin's a bully who only responds to strength. We should not be afraid to flex more muscle. President Zelensky has put the entirety of the West to shame through being what can only really be described as a hero to his people and to the world. He stood up to a country that's a lot bigger, a lot more powerful, that's committing war crimes, shooting people in the street, and the West refuses to put in a no-fly zone. And the West refuses to contemplate two troops on the ground. We refuse to call any Putin's bluffs. And as a result, Putin continues, and the Russian government continues, and the bodies on the ground in Bucha are partly the responsibility of the West's inability and unwillingness to undertake the necessary action needed to safeguard Ukrainian lives and the Ukrainian freedoms.
I mean, I'm gathering from your answer there that you would be in favour of a no-fly zone. Is that a fair assessment? Yeah.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. So what I was just going to say is, in your assessment, you'd be in favour of a no-fly zone and more military intervention. Troops on the ground. I'm just sort of like,
I think if necessary, I don't think we should rule it out. I think purely from a strategic point of view, I'm thinking back to before I became a teacher when I was doing foreign policy for a think tank. You're fundamentally not very sensible if you rule anything out. Fundamentally, what you'll do is you'll be giving away your strategic cards ahead of any potential thing, any potential intervention, which gives Putin time to plan effectively. I don't think we should take anything off the table as of yet.
Do you think that the reason that there has been reluctance over pressing this particular strategy is to do with the potential of nuclear escalation? And I mean, how realistic do you think nuclear escalation could be if there was a situation with a no-fly zone and troops on the ground?
I'd caveat this with the fact I'm not a military expert. I'm not pretend to be a military expert. I think we should take advice from military experts. I don't know is the honest answer, but I think what we can say with certainty is what we're doing now is not working. So it's looking at what happens next, because we can't leave Ukraine. We can't leave the people of Ukraine to be butchered in the streets for the very crime of being Ukrainian. We can't let false flag attacks by the Russians go unpunished. They're committing war crimes. Not to labour the point, they're going on a campaign to denazify Ukraine, who has a Jewish leader. I don't need to tell you how many which ways from something that is so offensive to the Jewish people, to anyone with a sense of decency. I think if we take things off the table, the issue with that is that you're implicitly endorsing his actions. Even if you're condemning them, you're implicitly endorsing them if you're not doing enough to stop them. You're going, yeah, we'll do this. We'll give the semblance of giving a damn. But actually, when it comes to actions to follow through. Sanctions are not enough. Sanctions won't bring back those people who have been murdered defending their country.
Absolutely. One of the things that has obviously been discussed and will hopefully at one time happen is some sort of Nuremberg-style prosecution of the Russians who were involved, who committed the war crimes. I mean, how likely do you think that is going to happen in the near future if we continue with the positions that we have in terms of sanctions and not implementing a no-fly zone or no troops on the ground?
Well, I think, again, I'm not an international lawyer. I can only speak sort of from a moral point of view. I think it's incumbent of the International Criminal Courts to set up a tribunal to investigate these crimes and to bring those who have perpetrated the crimes to justice, to bring the Russian army officers, who we know from Nuremberg that the thing of I was only following orders doesn't wash it, doesn't cut it, to bring the leadership of Russia. And that's not just Putin, it's Lebed, foreign minister. It's their spokespeople at the UN. It's the apologists on Russian state media who go, this stuff is fake news. It's everyone, you bring it to account and you help Russia transform into being a democracy. Because there are people in Russia who want to be a democracy. I don't know how effective it will be, but we need to certainly not hesitate and set up an international war crimes tribunal, because there are war crimes happening.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast, Callum. It's been great to have you on, and I have one final question for you. At the moment, it's award season for various films. We've had, obviously, the Oscars, BAFTAs coming up as well. And so my final question to you is this. If you had to pick any one actor, alive or dead, to play you in a film, who would you pick?
I think you sort of, I'm ginger, so you have to really go for Rupert Grint. I mean, but then again, Ed Sheeran did have that cameo in Bridget Jones's Baby. So either of those two. Can't think of any other ginger actors to off the top of my head, but it'll be one of those two. I feel Rupert Grint needs to come back to his acting career, because he's been a bit quiet over the last couple of years. And I'll be honest, the Ed Sheeran references get a bit boring, so we might as well switch it up a bit.
Well, I think that's a great answer. Callum, thank you again for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about you and about the campaigns that you're involved in, where should they go to find out more about you?
www.liberaldemocrats or libdems.org.uk. Join the Liberal Democrats. Myself, one of my colleagues will be in touch, and we'll get you part of the movement to change our country for good.
Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Callum.
No problem at all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.